And now, Prophecy Q&A with Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and Jimmy DeYoung Jr.
Thank you, Jay Johnson. This is Jimmy DeYoung Jr., and you're listening to Prophecy Q&A Live. Well, it's great to be back home, having just gotten back from Israel. I'm in my studios in San Antonio, Texas. We had a great trip in Israel. I think the last time that I talked to you, we were in the city of Jerusalem, getting ready to leave for the Negev, going down through the Negev to the city of Eilat with our trip of crossing over to Petra for one day and then coming back, spending a day on the Red Sea, and then bringing this last group home to the United States. It's great to be back with you. We had a great trip. One of these days, I sure hope that you would like to go with us. Join with us as we go to Israel. Go to our website, prophecytoday.com. Click on the link of Joshua Travel. You'll find out the next dates when we will be leaving for Israel again, and we would sure love to have you go with us. So we're looking forward to getting back to life as normal. Let me give you a couple things to think about in our future here as we are looking forward to what's taking place and what's going to come about. April 27th, 28th, and 29th, Dad will be in Branson, Missouri with Brandon House at the Worldview Weekend Family Reunion. April 27, 28, and 29 in Branson, Missouri. You can join Dad there if you want to make that over there. I do know I have a couple of friends that are going. My next-door neighbor has actually made his plans to be at the weekend in Branson, Missouri. June 11th through the 15th, right here in San Antonio, we're having our San Antonio Prophecy Conference, our School of Prophets San Antonio Prophecy Conference. This is our School of Prophets that we do, and you can work on your master's program if you want to come and just enjoy and learn, take the classes. We have three speakers that week. Dad will be teaching the Book of Revelation. Dave James will be teaching on dispensationalism and why it's so very important in your world today, in the Christian world in which we live in, even in all of your studies, determining how you look at the Bible, how you interpret a lot of different aspects of it, especially as it deals with prophecy. And then I will be teaching on the four major trends of Bible prophecy, which are the four things that you need to keep your eyes on if you're looking at Bible prophecy. We invite you to come join with us. Again, that's June 11th through the 15th, right here in San Antonio. We'll be staying at the historic Minger Hotel in downtown San Antonio. Beautiful place, right there on the Riverwalk, right across the street from the Alamo. We invite you to bring your family. They can join in with us in the conference, or while you're in the conference, they can be traveling around, going to Fiesta, Texas, SeaWorld here in San Antonio. There's so much to do with the Riverwalk. Go see the Alamo, the history of the Alamo, all kinds of different things. But we invite you to come along with us. We want you to hurry up and get your reservations in. Space is limited. Time is limited. And as we are making those plans right now, again, Dad will be speaking, teaching the Book of Revelation. Dave James will be teaching dispensationalism, and I'll be teaching the four major trends of Bible prophecy, June 11th through the 15th. Also, we have at the end of the summer in Gatlinburg, we'll have our School of Prophets Bible Prophecy Conference in Gatlinburg. We invite you to join with us, and soon you'll be able to find out what will be being taught at that one. I believe Dad will be teaching the Book of Ezekiel, and then we'll get you more information as to who else will be teaching there at that time and what they will be teaching. Well, we've got a lot of questions to get to this week, so we might as well get to them. Shannon Angel sends in a question. She says, one of the kids in my youth group asked this question. And don't you love those questions that kids ask? I mean, they could ask the most unbelievable questions. I remember one time Dad was talking and preaching on the Book of Revelation and the return of the body of Christ with Jesus Christ riding on white horses, and there was a young a teenager asked a question. He said, hey, Dr. DeYoung, when my dog died, did it go to heaven? No. When my cat died, did it go to heaven? No. Well, then where are we going to get those white horses that we're going to ride back on? Don't you just love those questions that kids ask? That's pretty amazing. But anyway, Shannon says this, one of the kids in my youth group asked this question, does the Bible say that in the end times we won't be able to tell the seasons apart? I have searched the Bible and have not been able to find this anywhere. Can you answer this for me? Shannon, that phrase is not in the Bible, that we won't be able to tell the seasons apart. I think what they're referring to is the passage in Matthew chapter 16, where the Pharisees and the Sadducees had come to Jesus trying to tempt him and saying, asking him to show them a sign from heaven. I'm not sure what sign they needed. I mean, they had already seen Jesus perform many miracles, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000. Actually, beginning all the way back with the first miracle at the wedding in Cana, and that's where he performed his first miracle. So they had already seen Christ perform many miracles. They had already seen many signs that he was who he said he was, that he was the Son of God. Interestingly enough, none of those miracles that Jesus did were for convenience sake. They all pointed to the fact that he was the Son of God. But it's in that passage in Matthew chapter 16 where Christ says, and he refers to the weather. Probably the most talked about thing every morning that we get up, we always look at the weather. And this is what Christ uses as an analogy for them as they are, you know, he said, listen, you can discern the weather. You can look at night when the sky is fair, and you could say that the next day is going to be good weather. I think the old adage was, the old sailor's thing, red at night, sailor's delight, red in morning, sailors take warning. This is where Jesus is saying to the Sadducees, you could tell the weather, you could tell by the signs of the weather in the sky, and you could determine what the next day is going to be. But he calls them hypocrites. He says, you can discern the face of the sky, but cannot discern the signs of the times. And I think that's the phrase that they're talking about. And again, this has to do with the fact that the Pharisees and the Sadducees were trying to find a sign. Not long ago, I was in the city of Caesarea Philippi teaching on this very subject, Matthew chapter 16, 17, and 18, that I was teaching on. Very interesting as you take a look at it, and the signs, even the signs in Matthew 24 and 25, those are the signs for the Jews as they are living in the tribulation period, discussing events that are going to take place during the tribulation period. We're not looking for signs, as we always like to say, we're listening for a sound. We're listening for that trumpet that will sound the rapture of the church, and we're caught up to be with him in the heavenlies. But it was the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and this is where this passage is talking about. And I think this will give an answer to your young people that Jesus wasn't talking to Christians. He wasn't talking about signs that we wouldn't be able to tell the weather in the end times. He was talking to the Pharisees and the Sadducees that were asking for a sign, and he makes this analogy to them. Shannon, by the way, thank you so much for your work with youth and in your church, and thank you for doing what you're doing, and keep up the good work. Robert Gianamore sends in a question, says, hey, Jimmy, I'm confused about who will be sitting on the earthly throne in the millennium, Christ or a resurrected King David. I am assuming David will be on an earthly throne, and he refers to Jeremiah 39, and Christ in heaven with the raptured saints, because Jesus said, where I am, you will be also, John 14:3. Can you give me some scriptural references? And Sarah Mayberry asks a question also. She says, what role will David play in the new heaven? Well, let me just give you an idea as we kind of go back. Let's take a look, Robert, at and you are correct in your references. In fact, in John chapter 14, that's the first time where Jesus Christ mentioned that he was going away to prepare. It's the first time he really addresses to his disciple about a rapture taking place, John 14, 1, 2, and 3, at the Last Supper, the Passover meal that he observed with his disciples. I always like to teach on that. In fact, I do a teaching on the Passover meal, and not so much of the Seder, but really what was in the mind of Christ and what was in the mind of the disciples that evening at the Last Supper, or at the Lord's Supper, as it's instituted there. And those disciples, they sure did not get what Jesus Christ was talking about. In fact, Jesus had to tell them a couple of times, I'm telling you these things so that when they take place, you will know that I am who that I say that I am. So it's very interesting when you take a look at John chapter 14, John chapter 13, as you take a look at what took place at the Last Supper. But your question about Christ sitting on the throne, I want to take you back to Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 24. "And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. And I, the Lord, have spoken." King David is going to be resurrected, as you talked about in Jeremiah 39, and it's talked about in Ezekiel 34, 24. And he's going to be co-regent with Jesus Christ at the temple. Chapter 37 also confirms that is going to be the case. And Ezekiel 37:24 says, "And David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they all shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments." Then notice in verse 25, "And my servant David shall be their prince forever." The word prince is used 24 times in the book of Ezekiel, and it is talking always about King David. So we see that King David is going to be a co-regent in Jerusalem, and he will rule with Jesus Christ. I think the key verse in Ezekiel 37, verses 26 through 28, "And I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will set them in their land and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in their midst forevermore. My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Then and the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever." So I think here we can see that after the rapture of the church, we'll be in the heavenlies while the seven-year period of tribulation is going on. We'll have the judgment seat of Christ, which will take place immediately after going into the heavenlies after the rapture. Then the marriage supper of the Lamb, where we will be married, the bride of Christ, the church, will be married to Jesus Christ. At the end of the seven-year period of time, Christ will come back to Jerusalem. He'll touch down his feet on the Mount of Olives, which will split. The campaign of Armageddon begins, where the armies of the nations of the world leave Jerusalem and head toward the Jezreel Valley. As Christ rebuilds the temple, he then heads to the Jezreel Valley, where he defeats Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet, and the armies of the world in the Jezreel Valley, where he gets the Jews that are protected in the city of Petra, which is 176 miles, by the way, from the city, from Megiddo to the entrance to Petra. He then brings them in by the eastern gate into the city of Jerusalem and into the old city. He goes into the Holy of Holies, and he becomes the high priest. Jesus Christ actually fulfilled the first four Jewish feasts in the spring in the proper day sequences. He will likewise fulfill the three Jewish fall feasts when he returns. He comes back on the Feast of Trumpets. He walks into the temple on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and the tabernacles. And the celebration begins with the millennial kingdom. That's when he will rule and reign from the temple that he built. Robert, I hope that helps you. And Sarah, I hope that gives you an explanation as to what King David's role will be on the earth, as he will be a co-regent with Jesus Christ in the temple. Let's see. God bless you. I have a question. Will the Antichrist be conscious of working for Satan? In other words, say, for example, Glenn Beck is coming off like he is doing the Lord's work. Does he know in his heart that he is on the other side of things and just pretending to be of God? No, I don't believe Glenn is the Antichrist, but I do think he is one of many. Thanks, my beloved brother. And this comes from Sherry. Sherry, let me just tell you this, that I think the Antichrist is alive and on the scene right now. You know, Satan is a very powerful person, one that we have to be very wary of. He's going around the earth seeking whom he may devour. I don't think that we have any control over Satan, and there are plenty of references in the Bible that we do not have power over Satan. Even Michael the Archangel in the book of Jude asked for Christ's help as dealing with Satan. So if he needed help, I certainly think that I don't have any, or you or anybody else has any control over Satan. But Satan is very powerful. But the one thing that he doesn't know is he doesn't know when the rapture of the church is going to take place, just like you or I don't know when the rapture of the church is going to take place. So I think that he has to have the person of the Antichrist ready at any moment and at any period of time in history. And I believe the Antichrist is alive and on the earth now. Now, you mentioned Glenn Beck coming off like he is doing the Lord's work. Personally, I think Glenn Beck is a deceiver. I think he's deceiving Christians. I think Christians are unaware and ignorant and are allowing themselves to follow Glenn Beck, who is a declared Mormon. And there's no secret on that. I mean, he even still proclaims to be a Mormon and follows the Church of Mormon. And I think that you need to be very clear on that, and people need to be very clear on that. From the Mormon point of view, he is doing the Lord's work. Mormons go to Israel. They look at the Bible. They look at the Bible as a storybook. But they definitely have their own theology and their own eschatology. The problem is, I think that, and you're aware of this, you're asking the question, I think Christians have dumbed themselves down so much that they are following along with Glenn Beck. Listen, our ministry has come under a lot of flack because we called Glenn Beck out and those people that were partnering with him. And so I would say be very careful. A lot of churches and pastors and groups are allowing Glenn Beck to come into their church. This is a man that belongs to a cult. I don't think Mormonism is a part of Christianity at all. Glenn Beck is clearly a Mormon, and these pastors and these spiritual leaders, so-called spiritual leaders, are allowing Glenn Beck to come into their flock, and our pastors need to be better shepherds. So be very careful as to who we let come in. And yes, there are a lot of different people on this earth that are anti-Christ, people that are taking us away. I'd be very careful who you let teach you. You know, one of the things that we could tell that the Antichrist will be on the sign, and one of the things that the Antichrist will use to show his powers is signs, wonders, and miracles. And we have a proliferation of signs, wonders, and miracles today. So be very careful. No, I don't believe, Sherry, that the Antichrist knows who he is at this point. This point in time. But I do believe when the rapture of the church takes place, that is Satan's signal that, okay, he has 7 years. Satan understands God's word. He understands eschatology, the prophecy of the last days and what's going to take place. I believe Satan knows that he has 7 years of time to get things done in order to accomplish his goal, which is to defeat God and to set up his kingdom on this earth and overthrow God. But I do know that when the rapture does take place, Satan will energize the Antichrist. And the first thing that the Antichrist does, we know, is he confirms that peace treaty with the Jewish people, with Israel, and he confirms he helps them build their temple. Midway through the tribulation, 3.5 years in, he will desecrate that temple and then proclaim himself to be God and persecute those people that have not taken the mark of the beast. Melody Interlachia writes in and sends a question. She says, who are the seed of Amalek today that you mentioned in your Prophecy Today e-newsletter on March 5th, 2012? And by the way, if you don't receive the e-newsletter, you can go to our website and sign up for the Prophecy Today e-newsletter. Well, Melody, let me give you a little preview. We did a documentary years ago that was entitled Esau and the Palestinians. I am going to play for you an excerpt from that video so that you can get your answer directly from Dad, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung in Israel, and possibly you might want to buy or purchase that video from our Prophecy Today bookstore on our website. Here's Dr. Jimmy DeYoung as he explains to you, Melody, who the seed of Amalek are today.
This is Mount Gibeah, located here at the edge of the Judean wilderness, just outside the city of Jerusalem. Behind me, the Jordan Valley, the Jordan River, the mountains across the Jordan River, the country of Jordan, modern-day Jordan. Location of Mount Seir in the days of Esau. That's where God directed Esau and his descendants to go to live. But the story of the two brothers continues here. This is the remains of a palace that the late King Hussein of Jordan was building just prior to the Six-Day War in 1967. It's also the site of the palace of the first king of Israel, King Saul. And Samuel the prophet would come here to continue the unfolding of this story of the two brothers. The unfinished palace of one king, the late King Hussein of Jordan, and the actual historic site of a palace of another king, King Saul, the first king of Israel. As we continue our story of the two brothers, it takes us to the book of 1 Samuel. That's the book in the Bible that records all the activities of this first king of Israel, King Saul. And as we come to chapter 15, we see that those things written in that book back in Exodus chapter 17 would be rehearsed before King Saul. In chapter 15 and verse 1, Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over all of Israel," right here in this location. "Now therefore, hearken unto the voice of the words of the Lord." Here's another message that God has from Samuel the prophet to King Saul. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when they came up from Egypt." Of course, that is recorded in the 17th chapter of Exodus and the incident that took place there at Rephidim. Verse 3, "Now go and smite Amalek, the grandson of Esau and the father of the Amalekites. Go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both the men and the women, the infant and the suckling, the ox and the sheep, the camel and the ass." God gave a directive to the prophet Samuel to tell King Saul, kill all of the Amalekites, all of their possessions. And interestingly, at this particular site here in Israel, the command would not be kept. After several days, the prophet Samuel returned to King Saul to see if he had been following the direction that had come from God through him, the prophet, to the king. Samuel asked King Saul, "Have you killed the Amalekites?" He assured him he had. "What about the animals of the Amalekites?" And as he was even speaking, "But," Samuel said to King Saul, "What was that?" "I'm not sure." "Now let me ask you again. You killed all of the Amalekites?" "Yes, I did." "You killed all of their animals?" "I said, but." And again the sound. Samuel said to King Saul, "Sounds like the voice, the sound of a sheep to me." He said, "Oh, that's right. I kept some of the sheep because they were pure, perfect, without blemish, without spot. I thought that we could offer them in sacrifice." Very interesting statement made by the prophet Samuel. He said, "It's better to be obedient than to offer sacrifice." And then the prophet Samuel asked King Saul, "Did you kill Agag, the king of the Amalekites?" "No, I didn't." "Why not?" "We could use his riches to further our nation, the nation of Israel." Now Samuel is very much disturbed with the disobedience of King Saul, so he tells him to bring Agag to him. Agag, the king of the Amalekites, stands there in front of him. The Bible tells us in chapter 15 of the book of 1 Samuel and in verse 33, "And Samuel said to Agag, the king of the Amalekites, as thy sword hath made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag into pieces before the Lord." God told Samuel to deliver the message to King Saul, kill all of the Amalekites. An Israeli general today, not too long ago, was talking with me, and he told me the problem, even in present-day Israel, is because of the failure of King Saul to to follow the command from God to kill all of the Amalekites. Today, the Israelis are continually confronted in conflict with the Amalekites. Well, this is not the end of the story of the two brothers. Some of these Amalekites escape from here in Gibeah. They made their way into Persia. I'll tell you more about that in just a few moments. I was just remembering a story that my son Jimmy told me as I looked at this, the unfinished palace of the late King Hussein. In 1994, when they had decided to sign a peace treaty with Israel, the Israelis allowed the Jordanians to have their king, King Hussein, who piloted his own 747, fly across the airspace of Israel. In fact, he flew over this unfinished palace. Jimmy and a good friend, Menno Kalashir, were out on the patio watching as the plane came down low so the king could see the palace. In fact, Jimmy told me he even saw the king at the cockpit of that big 747. Well, it was a palace where I take you for the next chapter in the story of the two brothers. It was a palace where King Ahasuerus reigned. He was the fourth of the Persian kings and the richest of all the Persian kings thus far. He was married to Vashti. You might remember the story as recorded in the book of Esther. King Ahasuerus dethroned Queen Vashti and then had his court bring before him candidates to become queen. He selected one named Esther. Unbeknownst to him, she was a Jewess, and she had a cousin whose name was Mordecai. One day, Haman, the number two in the land, the villain actually of the book of Esther, came walking through the gate. As he did, everybody bowed except one person, the cousin to the queen, Mordecai. Haman turned around and said to Mordecai, "You didn't bow to me." Mordecai said, "I'm not going to bow to you. I don't bow to anybody except God." Well, this very much disturbed Haman. He went into the palace. He met with the king, King Ahasuerus. He said, "You know how we had to deal with Queen Vashti? I think we're going to have to deal with these Jews now. There's one outside not respecting leadership. He did not bow to me as I entered the city." And of course, the king then looked to his second in command. "What should we do?" Haman said, "I think we should kill all of the Jews. You write down the law of the Medes and the Persians, and I will carry that law out, and we will kill all of the Jews." And of course, if you remember the book of Esther, for such a time as this, Queen Esther had come into the kingdom, and she would, of course, save the Jewish people. I told you that story only to bring you to a verse in chapter 3 of the book of Esther. Here's what it says. "After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Abedatha, the Agagite." The Agagite. He was a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites, in 1 Samuel chapter 15. The Amalekites? Well, they were all descendants of Amalek, the grandson of Esau. 36th chapter of the book of Genesis. Do you see the progression? Esau, Amalek his grandson, Agag, the king of the Amalekites, Haman, a descendant of Agag. Oh, by the way, Haman had a great-great-great-great-great grandson as well. His name? Herod the Great. All descendants of Esau. The blessing that Isaac gave to Esau, "You will live by the sword. You will kill your brother." The story of two brothers, conflict down through every generation.
Well, there you have it, Melody. You have a sample of our Esau and the Palestinians video that Dad did in Israel that I produced with him, the documentary that we did, tracing the lineage from Esau to the Palestinians of today. Of course, your question, who are the seed of Amalek today? That would be the Palestinians that live in Israel today that are vying for a state, for statehood. And God will deal with them in the future, according to the book of Obadiah. Hope that helps you, Melody. Thanks for sending in your question. Got a question that came in. Should Christians prepare for a possible economic downfall such as high inflation, food shortages, or attacks on our country? I realize we need to be spiritually ready and witnessing to others, but since we don't know how long we must wait before the rapture, do we need to prepare for short or long time survival for our families? Well, I would say that we just need to prepare as we would in any type of situation. We have to live in our world today. We have to plan. We must be wise fathers, husbands, leaders of our families. We need to take care of them. We need to have them ready. And we also need to be looking with one eye on the heavenlies and one eye on the earth and our families around us. I think it's foolish to bury our heads in the ground and say, we'll wait. I know that God's coming soon, and we know that we've all heard the stories. We've seen the news reports of religious groups that have done that. Don't think that's wise, but I think that we do need to be cognizant. We need to be understanding of the fact that the rapture could take place at any moment. I used to tell, when I would speak to young people, I used to tell them that we are living in the last days. And I really don't say that anymore. I say that because of everything going on around us, we're living in the last moments before the rapture of the church takes place. But until that time, we need to be very wise in how we live. We need to take care of our families. We need to prepare our families. We need to prepare for high inflation. We need to be proper stewards of what God has given us. We need to make sure that that we prepare our families in case there are food shortages or attacks on our country. I think that we need to be wise in that sense. And I don't think it's going to be a long time before the rapture of the church takes place, but we need to prepare as if it's going to be a long time, and spiritually be prepared as if it's going to be a short time away. Tommy sends in a question. Many prophecy teachers see Psalm 83 as a separate, distinct battle coming before Ezekiel 38's battle. Do you? We do not. We see those countries as the same. The players in Psalm 83 are slightly different than those in Ezekiel 38, and with Israel winning, that would leave them living in safety, albeit temporary. One of the major trends in our world today, Tommy, is that you can look at and recognize as an unfolding event that is going to give an indication or evidence that we are very close to the second coming of Christ, is the alignment of the nations against Israel. So let's take a look at the nations that are in Ezekiel 38 and start with verse 1. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog. Now Gog is the personality and Magog is the land. The chief prince of Meshach and Tubal prophesy against him. Then he continues on in verse 5 with the nations that are going to be involved against Israel. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. In verse 6, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma of the north quarters and all his bands, and many people with thee. So we read here in Ezekiel 38, the beginnings of the alignment of the nations, a coalition of nations that are going to come against Israel. Now let me tell you that as you approach your study of nations, you must remember that there is a hermeneutical principle as it relates to biblical geography. Hermeneutics is the science of interpreting scripture. Hermeneutical principles are used in every aspect of interpretation of scripture, and in particular in biblical geography. Their hermeneutical principle is, who was the author writing about when he wrote the book? In other words, when Ezekiel wrote the book 2,500 years ago, who was he thinking about? Who was on his mind when he mentioned Magog, Meshach, Tubal, Gomer, Togarma, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya? Who was he thinking about? Well, that's a good question. During the time of Ezekiel, Magog was a piece of real estate that was north of the Caspian and Black Seas. He referred to it as Magog then, but today we know it as Russia. Meshach, Tubal, Gomer, and Togarma were the four sections that Turkey was divided into during biblical times. So when you come to this, we are talking about Turkey. We're not talking about Germany, because Gomer sounds like Germany. No, we're talking about Turkey. Who was Ezekiel writing about? He had no idea of Germany 2,500 years ago. He was writing down what he knew to be locations. Then in verse 5, he talks about Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. Maybe your translation says Cush instead of Ethiopia, or maybe your translation says Put instead of Libya. Some of the countries are names we recognize today, but the boundaries may have been different in Ezekiel's time. Persia included the three nations we know today as Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. Ethiopia or Cush is Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. Libya or Put is Libya. These are the nations that are listed here. And go to Daniel 11 just for a moment. It gives us two other nations who will be a part of this coalition that are going to come against the Jewish people in the end times. Starting in verse 36, it refers to the Antichrist. Then in verse 40 and 41, it refers to the kings of the south and the kings of the north. Early on in chapter 11, the kings of the south rolls over what we know today as modern-day Egypt. The king of the north is modern-day Syria. So what we are talking about here in this passage of Scripture is that modern-day Egypt in the south and modern-day Syria in the north will attack him. It says in verse 40, attack him, the Antichrist. So now looking at those countries that we talked about, of course, those are the countries that are on our radar every night. If you watch the nightly news, any of the world news on a daily basis, all those countries are involved. And as a matter of fact, we know with the Arab Spring that has taken place and the overthrow of the regimes in the countries of Libya and Egypt, how those countries are now being controlled by the Islamic Brotherhood. In Psalm 83, the psalmist is praying to God. Notice what he says in his prayer in Psalm 83:1. It says, keep not thou silence, O God, hold not thy peace, but and be not still, O God, for lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up thy head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people and consulted against thy hidden ones. Now notice what they are going to say when they have this conference and come together. Verse 4 says, they have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. We want to wipe them out, forget their name forever. Let me just show you the names of a couple of these countries that we haven't already mentioned. Look at verse 6, the tabernacles of Edom. That's the Palestinians, and I'll talk. We've already talked about that in a question previous in this program. And they will be dealt with, as the book of Obadiah tells us. Look at the next one, the Ishmaelites. That's modern-day Saudi Arabia. And I'll explain that in just a moment. Look at the last one in verse 6, the Haganese. That would be modern-day Iran. That's a country to the east of Jerusalem. Then in verse 7, the last one listed in that verse is Tyre. Tyre and Sidon, that's modern-day Lebanon. In verse 8, Assur is modern-day Syria. It was July 9th, 2006 in Tehran, and 4,000 Islamic Arab leaders had gathered together. Ahmadinejad, president of Iran, was addressing the crowd. Here's what he said. We must rise up as Muslims and wipe Israel off the face of the earth, that their name may be forgotten forever. That's almost verbatim what was from the text, that their name may be forgotten forever. And that was in July 9th, 2006. On July 12th, Hezbollah broke across the northern border of Israel, killed some Israeli Defense Force soldiers, took two of them captive, and they ensued a 34-day war where the invincible Israeli Defense Force was brought down according to their perception. It was all under the context we must wipe Israel off the face of the earth, and their name may be forgotten forever. Now go back to Ezekiel 38, and let me show you what's going to happen to Islam. What is going to happen is that these nations are going to come. And let me tell you, when they are going to come, in the last phrase in verse 8, it says, they will come when the people are gathered out against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but they are brought into the land and dwelling safely. In verse 11, it says that they will live in unwalled cities. That's when the Antichrist has established a false peace, a pseudo peace. That's when the enemies attack and when the nations of Israel have laid down their weapons in unwalled cities. That means that they had laid down their defense. 2,500 years ago, a wall was in a place Today they have F-16 fighters, tanks, and Apache helicopters. When they lay down their weapons, these nations come to attack. Verse 18 through the rest of chapter 38 talks about how out of the heavenlies, Jesus Christ will lead an attack on these attacking nations. Look at Ezekiel 39:1. Therefore, thou son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. God is against thee, attacking enemies. Notice when it is going to happen in verse 2, and I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee. Now, if you have a different translation, it won't say five out of six are going to be destroyed, but verses 3 and 4 tell the story in Ezekiel 39. And I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. They shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort and to the beast of the field to be devoured. The rapture of the church is the next main event in God's calendar of activities. There will be a period of time after that before the 7 year starts. And the 7 year period starts when the peace agreement is confirmed by the Antichrist with Israel. When that happens, Israel lays down their weapons and these nations attack Israel. Then what happens? Five out of every six Islamic people on the earth will be destroyed. When does that peace agreement come? It immediately precedes the 7 year tribulation period. Well, Tommy, I hope that helps you, and I hope that helps you understand that those countries that are mentioned in Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38 are countries both that will be attacking Israel during the tribulation period. Well, folks, this brings conclusion to our program today. I hope that you enjoyed it. As always, we do this. Our ministry is based around the effort to try to make Christians aware of where we are living in light of God's timetable for the end times. The study of eschatology, the study of the last days. We use all of this to help us, to motivate us to live a pure, productive, holy life in an unholy world. And we also use it to motivate us to be about the work of evangelization, of being people that are living a life that's pure and productive and telling others about Jesus Christ. We are living in the last moments, and hopefully with everything that you are seeing, as you are being aware, that you are taking this information and sharing it with your family, your friends, your churches, and all those around you. Please use our website, prophecytoday.com, as Dag goes through the top 10 news stories of the day to help you determine where we are on God's timetable. And to keep living that life for Jesus Christ, using every day, every moment that we have to bring glory and honor to Him. There's really nothing left for us to say except let's keep looking up until...